Mini episode 312 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 312 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. Very pleased with the segment that we're going to be bringing to you today. On the program where we pride ourselves on the motto that nothing is off topic, we're going to be covering some very, very interesting content today. Some things about the future of web video with a gentleman who is right there in the middle of it, someone who has gone from old media platforms, traditional and legacy platforms, to the cutting edge of what's out there today with new media. Very pleased to have on this gentleman, one of our favorite past guests, works for him now with his program, John Bastow, who we were pleased to have on the show last year, is under the banner of the Zoom Video that this gentleman is the CEO of. It's a true pleasure to be able to bring on the show, as I said, someone who brings knowledge of old media, new media, and everything in between. And that would be, of course, the CEO of the Zoom Video, that, of course, being Tim Minton. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you on the FDH Lounge, sir. Welcome to the program.
Rick, delighted to be with you on FDH Lounge, and hope that we can talk about some things that will be of interest to the audience.
I'm sure we will. I want to thank you for the notes that you passed along. You made my job of doing research that much easier. I want to thank you for that, and again, it's a very interesting story that you have personally, as well as what's going on with the Zoom Video. So I guess we could start with that as far as what prompted you in the course of what was a rather long and illustrious journalism career with the New York Times locally and in TV for the NBC affiliate in town. I understand the ABC affiliate in New York as well. You decided to make the leap to new media. You did so with both feet. What was the thought process? How's it gone in the 2 years since?
Well, it's been successful. And the reason that I thought there was a reason to make a move, which to a lot of my friends seemed a little zany, at least at the time, is because of the way that people look at the news and look at video now. And you and your audience would know from personal experience. I mean, how many of your friends make an appointment to watch the 6 o'clock news or the 5 o'clock news or even the 11 o'clock news? It's not to say that they're bad programs, because they're not. And there are good people and very smart people who are working on them. But the reality is, it's not the way people get their news today. They get it from friends who share on Facebook. They get it from internet alerts. They get it from going online. And they get it principally from video in many cases. And so my thought was, and this was 2.5 years ago, really almost 3 years ago now, was that if you wanted to be where the puck was going to, you know, skate the old Wayne Gretzky line, skate to where the puck is heading, you had to be online. You had to be producing video and news content that is short, that's available anytime people want it, and that is engaging, meaning what we do is entertaining, not just informative. And my thought was, there's a real world out there, a real appetite, a demand for it. And I went inside NBC at 30 Rock, where I was working, and spoke to the highest executives at the network, suggesting that this was something I thought the network should be moving to. It was already moving in that direction, and that I had some ideas to be part of it. And what became clear to me was, if I wanted to pursue it, I was going to have to pursue it somewhere else, because at that point I was more valuable to NBC as a news correspondent, and they had a lot of other people who were exploring online digital initiatives. So What we did is another correspondent named Jada Dapper and I and a news executive, a veteran executive from several networks named Philip O'Brien, decided to found a company and build some brands where we would bring news, information, entertainment, all sorts of topics to people in that way, the new way, video, online, on demand, for mobile on devices. And it's been very successful. We've got a number of brands, but the best known of them, Rick, is something called Buzz 60. So if anybody in the audience is trying to find it, you can go to Zoom Video, which is our home website, and navigate around, or you can just put Buzz 60 into any search engine, and you'll get a whole lot of results because we're on AOL and Yahoo and 7,500 websites, really more than that now, all over the world with people watching these programs.
Absolutely. And I always like to help plug effectively what's going on here. So I just want to spell out for everybody that in any case that they are not aware of the spelling of it, they should be. But if they're not and they can't figure out the phonetics of it, ZAZOOMvideo.com. So Zoom Video would be what the URL to go to for all of this. And I really want to continue to dive into the micro level and your perch in the industry and what you're seeing with your company. But I want to ask you a macro question as a little bit of a follow-up, Tim. This was something we put recently to the show to a good old DMD of the Webby Awards when he was on with us. And just the sense that 2013, at least on the surface, appears to be kind of a year of seeming to be retrenchment towards traditional platforms when you look at Larry King's show now migrating to the Russian International Cable Channel. You've got Oprah's TV channel picking up One Life to Live and All My Children. They didn't want to continue to put all of their bets on online, at least in the near term. Have you noticed that as far as 2013, that there's a little bit of maybe impatience at the pace at which new media is continuing to develop and web video, or do you see those as a little bit of an outlier?
Well, it depends what you mean by impatient. If what you mean is that some people in the industry are looking to hedge their bets or recognizing the reality that today in 2013, there's still a much larger audience on traditional media, meaning television, still broadcast, called that for a reason. But if what you're asking is the audience impatient, I would suggest that the answer is an emphatic no. The audience wants their content, their video, their stories on mobile devices. 71% of the video that is consumed now online is on mobile in many platforms, according to recent studies. And that is consistent with what you know from your own experiences and your friends. So what we're finding and what the reality is that there are basically three types of consumers of entertainment and other programming, topical programming, news programming on video. One is the people who are still watching it the old-fashioned way. They're either watching it through regular television with an antenna, or they're digital, or they're watching it on cable. So that's one group. Then there's the group that's known as the cord shavers, where they're watching still a bunch of their programs on the traditional media, but they're now starting to use services like Netflix to stream video, and they're starting to migrate online. Then you have your cord cutters, the people who have decided, I'm not going to pay the Comcasts and the Fios and the Time Warners, forget the cable, I'm done with cable because I can get everything I want either online or by streaming, possibly through subscriptions. And then, and Rick, this is the interesting thing to me, is you got the people who in the industry are known as the cord neverers, because the people who are growing up now, the teenagers, people in their 20s, many of them have never had cable television subscriptions. Maybe they lived in homes where there was cable, but in their own world, their own lives, it's all about online. It's all about what they're sharing from friends. And so if you ask those people, are you impatient with the migration to online viewing of video or mobile viewing, they'll say, what are you talking about? It's the only place that we're watching right now. And I'm telling you, talk to your friends or your kids or their kids. And, when I speak on college campuses, the first thing I ask is, how many of you watch news on local television? And these days, you get a smattering of hands, maybe 2 to 3% in an audience. And then I ask, how many of you look at print newspapers? And it's zero, basically. And then, how many get it online? And it's everybody. Because in that world, the 20-somethings, the millennials, right, the used to be called Generation Y, it's all about that's the world they grew up in, the only world they know, and they're very comfortable in it. And it's hard to see where in 10 years or 15 to 20 years there's still a traditional television. The reality, Rick, I think, is give it 5 years and there's going to be convergence and it's one box or one screen or one device, and every type of programming is available on that device. That's where it's headed.
Yes, absolutely. I just got an interactive TV module myself recently, and yes, as you correctly suspected, I was asking about decision makers primarily in the industry, and possibly a little bit of impatience setting in, because again, it has been very, very difficult, as everyone knows, to monetize new media, at least to the level of a lot of expectations out there, web video, et cetera. So this is a perfect, actually, pivot point back to what I wanted to focus on with sort of the micro level with what you're doing there, with your perch in the industry and what you're seeing. What do you have to tell people out there about the pace at which things are being monetized with web video, and what have been some of the big lessons you've learned in your 2 to 3 years of running Zoom?
Well, first of all, it's not easy to monetize web video for a lot of reasons, and probably most of them your audience doesn't care about. The companies that are successful and that will be successful will have diversified streams of revenue, different ways to make money. So one way will be you distribute videos and share revenue or money from commercials with other people who are either selling them or whose publisher sites your video is appearing on. So you're sharing around. Another way to make money is you're creating customized content for a particular company. So there's a media company that wants to have some news done in a certain way, and it's cost effective for them to outsource that, and then you do news for their website, right? It might be a television station company. Their main business is television. They do that very well, and their choice for their website is either take something they've done for television and move it over to the website, or have another company where the business of that company is creating video specifically for websites, specifically for devices, and have that company do it with your brand. That's another way to make money. And a third way that's gotten a lot of attention is working directly with sponsors or brands. And you've heard of the term, I suspect, native advertising, and there's branded content. And really where that gets interesting, and sometimes not in a good way for a lot of traditional news people, and I would put myself in that category, is that there's a blend of where does the journalism stop and the commercial part start. And the trick is, if you want to be successful, you're working with brands. It's a good idea. It's a good thing. We don't want to be afraid of it. But at the same time, you have a pact with your audience. And the pact says, if we give you some information, then we're being straight with you. We're not telling you something because we're being paid by somebody to advocate a certain way, or because they want us to introduce you to something that really wouldn't be that interesting, wouldn't meet our standards, but we're going to do it because we're getting paid for it. So, where we come down on that is we're willing to tell stories that are of interest to a particular group of viewers that a sponsor wants. So, for example, I'll give you an example. We do not have a deal with Starbucks, and I'm deliberately picking something we don't have a deal with because it's not appropriate really to talk about the nature of specific deals that we have with sponsors, but this is a good example. So let's say we were looking to put video on the Starbucks digital network, which is the network that you log on to for free if you're in a Starbucks. What we would do is we wouldn't be suggesting that it would be a good idea to do video about coffee, right? You're in Starbucks. They have great coffee. They're selling you the coffee. You don't need stuff about coffee, and Starbucks wouldn't want us to be talking about coffee. But if it was in the morning, the people who go to Starbucks are business people, by and large. I mean, at least in cities, in urban areas. And what are they interested in? Well, they're interested in finance. They might be interested in sports. So that could be two categories that would be very important to those people, and you'd want to program video about finance and sports and some other things, but those in particular. Now you get to 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the people using that same Starbucks network all across the country, thousands of stores, are not the business people. They're at the offices. Now it's the soccer moms. It's the people who have disposable time in the middle of the day to go and get a latte or whatever they're there for, and they have different interests. They might be interested in parenting or fashion or fitness and health. So you program video that appeals to that type of interest. You're working, if we did, and again, we don't have a deal with Starbucks, but you know, this would be the kind of thing we would do. You're working with a brand to reach their target customer and bring presumably more customers into that restaurant in this example by creating good quality stories about subjects that their customers care about and by extension bringing more of those customers into the store. To me, that's not crossing the line. That's not cheating. That's not, you know, saying you're doing something because you're being paid and it's somehow immoral or unethical. But it is working effectively and legitimately with a brand, and that's a big part of the future, I think, of the media business, is bringing brands a little bit closer to the newsrooms, but in a positive, reasonable way that lets the journalists like me go sleep at night very peacefully.
Well, Tim, that was a very good example you had there of Starbucks, of how you would program that. I would dare say it doubles as the seed of a very good pitch to them if you decide you ever want to go get that business. I think you laid it out pretty well. So best of luck with the subsequent pitch to Starbucks. It sounds like you got a good basis there. But
We're talking to a lot of people about a lot of things, as you would imagine.
Yes, I can well imagine under the circumstances. And with what you said there about journalism and with, as I indicated previously, some of the notes that you were kind enough to pass along to me to help me prepare for this conversation about the changing nature of journalism, and I think you started to touch on it a little bit there. That kind of pricks my ears as somebody that went to one of these legacy schools, the E.W. Scripps School at Ohio University, where they really kind of drum certain things into you about journalistic lines. So it's very interesting.
Which is
to hear
a sensational school,
that.
By the way. That's a great, great school. It's in Athens, right?
It is. It is indeed. Yes. I am nothing but very pleased with my time that I spent there and what was taught to me. And really, again, one of the great bargains in America that I can't recommend enough to anybody. But
Under the radar, and they do a terrific job.
It's an old line kind of, or at least it was when I was there, a traditional mentality of, I was in the news ed side. I didn't really take too many classes on the PR side, so it might have been a little bit different there. But it does sound as though from what you're saying that there is this changing world that's going on there, a little bit of blurring of lines, as Robin Thicke might perhaps say, and that you basically are going to have to try to stay focused on keeping your integrity while being creative and open to other possibilities. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think he might, Robin might have something else in mind when he uses that phrase, but
yeah.
there's no question, and anybody who watches local news, particularly all across America today, knows this, that because of the cuts in resources, which has resulted from the cuts in advertising dollars going into local news, which has resulted from the evaporating audience for local news, so it all kind of trickles down. What has happened is when the budgets get cut, what doesn't get cut? The news hole, right? They still need to fill the 22 minutes out of a half hour that's not commercials, and some of that is sports and weather, but some of that is news. Well, what do you do? If you're a news director in America today, and you're faced with the choice of you've got a budget that's cut, so you can't get more money, but you can want to continue to do a certain level of quality and standard, what do you put on? And the answer, as people have seen, is you put on a lot of stories about crime. You do a lot of news conferences. You do the stories that fill the time, and you can tell a quality story about the robbery that happened at the bank this afternoon. It's not about the level or the standard of the reporting or that particular reporter, but really, if you think about it, in today's world where people go where they want, not where a news department tells them to go for content or news or video, who's going to decide if you have a menu of celebrity news, something entertaining, a wacky story about some twist that you haven't heard about in Justin Bieber's life, or it could be something strange that happened on at the McDonald's down the corner, whatever it is, or you can look at the latest kidnapping or assault story that happened in some neighborhood 20 miles away from you. Where are you going to go? And yet the lead to the 11 o'clock news every night, and then the second story and the fourth story and the sixth story and the seventh story, and this isn't about one network or one station or one community, because it's all across the country and it's all the different network-owned stations and the affiliates. What you're seeing is crime time, because it's cheap, it's easy, and it's what they can afford to cover and still maintain some modicum of a quality standard in terms of the production value. But that's a big change from 10 years ago. 10 years ago, stations, certainly in the bigger markets, had units that did medical, that did investigations, that did consumer, that did health, that did a whole bunch of other things. And some, in some places, that still exists up to a point. But there's a lot less of it going on, and there's really no reason to believe that it's going to suddenly change, that part of the business is going to be resuscitated. I give you one example. When I started in local news in New York, which is maybe now about 20 years ago, was my first local news job. If you combined all of the ratings of the three stations, it would be maybe, let's say, a 23 rating. And it doesn't matter really what that ties to in viewers. The point is the relative rating over the years. So let's say it's a 23. Now, and the station that was number one might get a 14 at 11 o'clock. Now you look at the local news, and all the stations combined be lucky to get a 5. Well, what does that tell you about the business model, right? It's still broadcasting. That 5 is still worth, on a good night in New York, more viewers than Bill O'Reilly has on his newscast. His Fox show, which is the most popular show on cable, but it's an evaporation of the audience, and the dollars have gone with it. And there is absolutely no reason to believe that's turning around. None. So, what happens next? What happens is people are going online, and they're getting shares from their friends. That's the new news service, and it's what we call in the industry the long tail. You go to what you're interested in, and instead of having hundreds of thousands of viewers all joining their communities at 11 o'clock or whatever the time is to watch a newscast that they're all watching at the same time, now you have 2,000 people here, 500 people there, a couple thousand people over there watching the stories about topics they actually care about, many of which were shared by friends or blogs promoted them, and they follow those blogs, they got texts, whatever it was. That's the new newscast in America, and that's the change. And if you asked me, what's wrong with that, what I would say is nothing except there's a certain kind of reporting that's important in a democracy that doesn't get done anymore for the most part. And that's investigations, it's in-depth politics coverage in local communities. It's done much better on a national scale. And, you know, that should scare people, that there are all those investigations that used to go on that kept people honest, politicians, contracts involving your money. Nobody's looking at it now. In some places, there are still newspapers that have aggressive staffs, but for the most part, nobody's watching, and that's not good.
Absolutely, Tim. I'm a big free market guy, but I'd be the first to admit the free market is not going to be the first in line to subsidize investigative journalism and the like. It's kind of hard to see that being the case. But you've touched on something specifically maybe a little bit earlier, along the lines of a projection of internet and TV kind of all coming together here. That's been one of the most enduring topics on our show over a period of time. One of our program regular contributors, our good friend Simon Applebaum, also from the New York area, this has been a constant kind of back and forth with him, kind of taking the pulse of things. And I believe you threw out the figure previously, 5 years as far as projected incorporation. I'd like to know from you what specifically you envision when that day comes. You've got a network like, and granted, they might be the only one that's real healthy, but CBS, they look like they could do appointment viewing for maybe another decade or so. But when everything comes together, everybody has the sense of, oh, well, programs will be available for download at a certain time. It'll be a fragmented thing. We won't have 20 million people watching the same show anymore, other than sporting events, which you can see from the rights fees why they're valued so highly right now, because they're kind of the exception to that rule. But is it really 5 years that you see for that? And at the end of that 5 years or whenever, you know, how do you see it shaking out exactly? Is TV basically going to mirror the internet as far as being an on-demand world?
Well, I think that, you know, it's 5 years for some people. The early adopters are already doing it right now, and the it is having a screen that allows you to access whatever programming you want in one place. And you know, most of the early adopters can do it in two places. One is the TV that's a connected TV is what it's called, that can get the internet with a remote the same way that you get TV or cable. And the other is the iPad or tablet, whatever tablet somebody uses. In some cases, it's a mobile phone, but for now, the technology is a little bit rough there to get every kind of programming. And what it means is that everything's on demand. Everything is accessible, whether it's internet, streaming service, television, cable. That's why if you're a subscriber to HBO, you can get HBO Go or Showtime or Cinemax or any of them. The TV everywhere, the ability to get your TV. It's not just Slingbox and their competitors. It's everybody, because they want you to have it wherever you are. Now, the tough part is they haven't yet figured out an efficient way to measure the audience that's watching in all these places and disparate times and locations and methods. And that's a problem not for the HBOs, because they're getting subscriber fees and you've got to log in, or there are other ways technologically they can make sure you're a subscriber. It's a problem, though, if you're CBS and you're trying to convince Pepsi that you have a certain level of audience that demands the prices that you're charging for commercials, and you can't prove to Pepsi or whoever the sponsor is that you've got that audience, because what you're doing is speculating that 30% of your audience is watching on these devices at different times that you don't have the technological ability right now to track. So you know, that's part of an issue. But the broader point here is that the technology is already there. The demand for people, which is also common sense, to be able to watch what they want, wherever they want, is already there. And it's just a question of getting enough programming to be developed that makes sense for all those different places and being able to get the financial model. In other words, the sponsors are buying into this idea that there really is an audience that's watching. And then there's the question of, well, okay, if you can get it on demand and I'm a sponsor and I'm advertising, let's say it's an offer that's good for a week, you know, do I really get value if 20% of the audience watching that program watches in a month on demand? But then there's a new paradigm for sponsorship, which is I can sell a sponsorship for the first week that's going to watch it on television and watch it on the iPad or however they're accessing it. And then anybody that streams the same show starting on the eighth day will get a different advertisement. And there's technology now that allows advertisers in some cases in real time to change the commercial message based on who's streaming it or where. You know, that's another kind of scary, is what all of the programmers and their sponsors know about you based on where you're downloading whatever they're selling. But you know, the reality is what's saving the networks, if not today, because they still have other things, but in 5 years, is what you said. It's the sports, and to a lesser extent, it's the live breaking events of whatever kind, like this Sunday, the Emmy Awards. People want to watch that live, and that's probably not going to change. But other than that, everything else is up for grabs and will clearly be available, because it already is, to a certain extent, on, you know, one screen wherever you are. Everything comes together.
Right. Great points there, Tim. And again, yeah, substantiation of the metrics, obviously a big key to monetization, so that advertisers actually know what they're getting. And clearly that's going to be a very important thing going forward. And as we've covered, there is such a great catalog that's already there and growing by the day at Zazoom Video, ZAZOOMVideo.com. And again, like I said previously, Tim, we always like to plug away as much as we can on this. You've got the great Buzz 60 brand there that, again, our friend John Basedow and a great many others are contributing to as well.
He's terrific, isn't he, John, with the
fitness? What an amazing guy, yeah.
And the health, well, it's about his attitude toward things. It's fascinating and it's fun. You know, you can put John Basedow Buzz 60 and see all the stuff he's doing for us and also his Stu crew elsewhere.
Sure. And not to put you on the spot or make you play favorites, but are there any other things here while we're plugging away that kind of jump out at you that the listeners should know about?
Well, I think that, you know, if you're a listener, the question is, why do you care about all this, you know, stuff with the sponsors and you know, what's going on in the industry? You watch what you want to watch. You get it the way you want to get it. And, you know, what I would say to that is it's a lot more democratic now. So if you want to see a program about gardening, you used to have to figure out how to get it off the BBC's feed somewhere, and you don't anymore. Now there's probably 17 blogs, many of which are quality, some of which are doing video, and you know, obviously YouTube, you can put in whatever you want. But I think that, you know, in the end, the reason you care what's going on is that you want to have a certain level of quality be sustained. You don't want to get junk. And that's the risk here, is that if the whole, you know, market for television and for programming, wherever it is, ends up descending into the abyss because it's hard for the companies that are presenting it to you to figure out how to make money, how to find you and make money, then the programming is going to be lousy. And there aren't going to be as many choices. And maybe you're going to have to pay directly for some of the programs like the sporting events that you're getting for free now. I'm not predicting that, but that's the risk. And I think there's a real big question about, you know, what we were talking about before with, you know, who's watching the government. And I don't mean to be, you know, esoteric. That's real. That's your tax money. And in local communities, the answer is nobody, right? You're paying your taxes.
Yeah.
in Omaha and Dubuque and Harlingen, Texas, and Redding, California, and everywhere else, and nobody is watching the people who are taking your cash to see what they're doing with it. That's terrible. And there's an organization, I'll plug one organization I have no vested interest in, and that's called ProPublica, which is based here in New York. They're at ProPublica.com, it's either .com or .org, I should know, but you put ProPublica in. These guys are out there doing now investigative journalism in a way that nobody else is, and then they give their stuff away for free. You know, they're funded by a foundation, and they give their stuff away for free, and major news organizations that used to have their own investigative staffs, and some that still do, are running these articles and these videos because they feel that it's the only way now that they can serve the audience the way they use, or their readers in some cases, the way they used to themselves because of what's happened to journalism and to the media business. A plug for my friends at ProPublica because they deserve it, and we hope if people want to have some fun and be entertained while they're being informed on a whole variety of subjects, that they'll check out Buzz 60 because they'll have some fun with it.
Absolutely, and some great larger points about society in this conversation we've had with you, Tim, both about the decline of investigative journalism and the fact that there aren't too many outlets like ProPublica that are out there at this point, as well as what you said before about big data. That big data pretty much equals Big Brother right now, as a guy named Ed Snowden was telling us a couple of months back. So, you know, that is the viewing habits online are certainly being stocked away by many different entities out there. On the other hand, maybe it makes it a little bit easier for monetization in the long run and proof that there are eyeballs on these products. And we know that there are a good number of eyeballs on the products. It's a Zoom Video and Buzz 60. And it was just a great conversation with you, Tim. I was really looking forward to getting the chance to do this. Love to have you back on and continue to follow what's going on with your fine organization.
Thanks, Rick. That's very gracious of you. Love to come back. And I think you just touched on something, by the way, which would be a good program sometime for you to do, which is Snowden talked about the secrets that the government keeps, but people have no idea what data has been compiled by the people, the companies they do business with all the time. Just about everything we do now, I don't mean we at Zoom, I mean we consumers do in terms of looking at pages on the internet or buying books or whatever we buy on the internet, it's all setting up profiles of us that are then readily available to companies that want to sell us stuff. And if, you know, I don't know that there are many people don't believe that, but if you don't believe it, you know, start looking at the kind of ads that are showing up on your screen in your homes when you go online. Even if you're not searching for something in particular that the ad is related to, think back a day or two ago to when you were, and that's why you're getting those advertisements. And, you know, some people are okay with that, and some people think it's a good service. But other people may not be quite as comfortable that all of these companies, marketing companies and other companies, know an awful lot about all of us just based on what we're doing in the privacy of our homes. So you tease that, and that's a good subject to take on at some point, too.
That would be tremendous. I appreciate the suggestion. And, again, we try to be the widest variety out there for any kind of a talk show, highbrow, lowbrow, middlebrow, you name it. And that would be certainly one of the great things that we could tackle at some point and get into. And it's, as I said, been a tremendous conversation with you, Tim. Very enlightening. These are the kind of great conversations we like to have with our guests. I'll look forward to having you back here at some point. Thank you so much, sir.
You're welcome. Look forward to it. Thanks, Rick.
Appreciate it, and thank you all for tuning in, everybody. Mini episode number 312 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IAmBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.